Hello and welcome to another episode of The Week That Really Was for the week ending the 8th of March 2024. Today is polling day in the referendums on the whether to delete a woman's place in the home from the Constitution and whether to expand the definition of family to include durable relationships. Sarah, I have never been happier to see a campaign end.
Yeah, I'm pretty bored of it now. Pretty boring. Although there's been some good debates this week, I'm tired of it. And I'm also almost perversely mesmerised by the government's shameless misinformation campaign that when they criticise misinformation all of the time and about the scourge of, you know, fake news and misinformation online, and they have been, you know, definitely enjoying that, the spreading of misinformation themselves in this campaign. And I've been mesmerised at how shamelessly they've done that. But anyway, I'm glad it's over.
Well, to be honest with you, that's only part of the reason I'm glad it's over. I'm glad it's over because it's, you know, from the point of view of editing a news outlet, it was a very stressful week because everybody in the last week of a referendum campaigning on both sides goes a little bit mad. And everybody and their mother wanted Gript to cover their argument, this argument, go to this event, go to that event. And you're sitting there going, on the one hand, you know, I appreciate your campaigning, you're doing a democratic service, you're participating in our democracy, more power to you. On the other hand, if we covered everything you want us to cover, literally we would have been wall-to-wall referendum stuff and nothing else. So I'm hoping it'll quieten down a little bit next week. And poor Noble, who's our cameraman and chief video editor, I mean, he's just done Trojan work in this campaign. I think he's done 3 weeks work in 1 week this week between going to various events and what have you. So it's been incredibly busy for us on that side of it too. Obviously, we issued an editorial the other day saying that in the view of my colleagues and I, a no vote is the way to go. But that said, the other thing that was stressing me out was that while that is our editorial view, as a media outlet, we are obviously obliged to cover and present the arguments to our readers from both sides. And I have to say, I got some people kind of going, you know, why are you covering the yes side at all? Well, it wouldn't be really fair if we didn't. You know, we're not, that's not what we are. We're not a campaigning outlet. We have to try and inform our readers too. So I think a lot of people, and by the way, on both sides, got a little bit manic this week, as always happens in the last week of a campaign. And so that was a little bit challenging from an editorial point of view. So I'd be glad when it's over.
And I think that that's partly because the no side started to smell blood in the water and the yes side started to feel it slipping away from them.
Yeah, that poll in the Sunday Independent last Sunday. I mean, obviously, you could be listening to this on Monday and it could have been a yes, and this could all sound ridiculous. But as now when Sarah and I are talking, I mean, the definite vibe from campaigners on both sides is that at least one, if not both, of these referendums is going down. Now, if you are listening to this on Monday and they both passed 60-40, that is just an insight into what people were thinking. And not just Sarah and me, people in the political world were thinking on sort of Thursday evening before the voting started.
But you can have a feeling about something. I mean, if they both pass on Monday and it's 60-40, I think that would indicate to me that it was 80-20 a week ago. You know what I mean? That it's slipping away. Whether it's slipping away enough is a matter I don't know.
Yeah, exactly. But that's a good moment, because if people are listening on Monday and they want to judge your political nose, and I'll pitch in as well, give me your prediction. What do you think it's going to be?
So it has changed this week. Last week I felt it was going to be a yes. Then I started over the weekend kind of feel like it was going to be a no on durable relationships, but still a yes on the care one. And then I think that the care one has started to slip away as well. I think it's going to be a no on both. That's going to be my prediction. It's hard because that's what I want to happen. And sometimes I feel like you just get totally blindsided by, you know, I feel like your best political prediction is always on the thing that you actually don't care about in the slightest, because you don't let your emotional desire for what you want to happen impact your decision. But I think that based on not what I think, but the profile of the people in the last few days who've told me that they've switched to no, I'm going to say it's they've lost it.
Okay. I am, as you know, an inherent pessimist. And I would have been instinctively, from the beginning, a no on both of these referendums. But I have to say, I haven't been as emotionally invested as some people. Because if I have a criticism of the no side in this campaign, and I hope I can say this now with a couple of hours, you know, by the time you're listening to this, at most, there'll be a few hours left in voting. I think the no side, you know, while I agree with them, I think there was a significant over-egging of the pudding among some people as to, like, just how important all of this is. In that I don't think this was going to have immediate or lasting detrimental implications were it to pass. I view it kind of like, you know, remember a couple of years ago where they reduced the waiting period for divorce. Like, you know, you can have an opinion on that, but I don't think it's the most important thing in the world. And that was kind of my attitude to this, which gave me a bit of detachment. And about 2 weeks ago, I was very much in the, yeah, it's going to pass. It's going to be a yes, yes. But like you, just in the last week, I picked up the same signals and people have gone to my head and made me predict, I would say it would be a no, no. And that clip will now be played, if it's a yes, yes, by all my friends for the rest of time going, McGurk wrong again, because I have been known to get these things wrong in the past. And people seem to really enjoy pointing it out when you get them wrong. But I wouldn't be surprised by either result. But if you put a gun to my head, I think no, no.
I think at this point, I would be surprised by yes, yes. I think that a yes and a no would surprise me less. But I think both of them passing would surprise me at this point. But like you say, who's to know? I think turnout in this one is going to be a huge factor. And I think that the fact that a lot of people still don't understand what this is really about. I mean, I saw one of the online media platforms today was doing a kind of a stop and talk, interviewing people on the street about the referendum and if they're planning to vote. And there were so many people, especially young people, and I think it's so funny, who were saying, you know, I just don't think the government have informed us enough. And, you know, I don't know what this is about. I just think the government has failed to provide the information. Sorry, what? Read it then. Like,
yeah.
Am I being mad? But do you not have a civic duty to kind of inform yourself? I mean, okay, the government's campaign can be not great and the information that's provided can be not great, but you're able to look up the constitution and look up the puzzle and educate yourself. This is weird. Am I mad or is it?
No, you're not. And like, I look, let's state this with the proviso that we are both exceptional political nerds. I mean, we could both probably name 40, 50 TDs and most people could barely name the ones in their own constituency. So like we are outliers on one level.
For sure. There's nothing I love more than Italian spreadsheet.
Yes, exactly. So you are an outlier. Yeah. That said, I agree with the general thrust of what you're saying. Like the fact that people are saying, oh, I don't know, the government didn't tell me. I mean, the government's job is not to inform you in a democracy. Your job is to be informed about what the government is doing and hold it to account and endorse it or reject it, as the case may be. It is not the government's job to spoon feed you information. Governments are inherently oppositional to you. In that they have every interest in deceiving you. That's the other thing. People are like, oh, if only the government told me. Governments, and I don't care whether it's a government you agree with, if you're sitting here kind of going, well, you know, I wish it was the Irish Freedom Party in power. The Irish Freedom Party in power, and I don't mean this is an attack on them, would have the same inherent interest in deceiving you as Fianna Fáil or Fine Gael do. Governments have an interest in presenting their version of events to you, and they should always be viewed with skepticism. So if you're kind of taking their word for it, you're not even doing your job as a voter. That's my view. Anyway, you know what we haven't done in ages?
What?
Is read out some comments.
Yes.
And there have been a few. I mean, you've been getting a lot of praise recently. There was one last week that said, quote, is that available stitched on a pillow in bullshit house? That's apparently a phrase that you used last week. There was somebody said you were brilliant when you get annoyed about something. So I'll have to piss you off a bit more on this show.
I'd like to give you that one I'm going to read out, John, which is Ryan's contribution here hurt my ears. Non-stop horse shite. McGurk talking his usual bollocks, but we're used to it by now. Thanks, Dad.
Well, can I just say I'm very grateful to that person for listening to us. I am glad that, if we are arousing passions in you, if you're somebody who hates listening to us and you're listening anyway and you're getting really annoyed and it's, increasing your blood pressure a little bit, I'm glad, because maybe you've got low blood pressure and that's helping you out, or maybe you're just being entertained. So, I have a thick skin. I don't mind that. And I do occasionally, as I mentioned in relation to predictions, get it wrong. So feel free to point that out.
We don't take ourselves that seriously, so it's fine. Yeah.
Somebody suggested we should play a song at the end of the podcast, like a fade out of the national anthem or something. I don't know. I have terrible memories, Sarah, of being in like teenage discos where they'd play the national anthem at the end of the night. And
God, I forgot about that.
Yeah.
Do that still in teenage discos?
Sorry?
Do they still do that in teenage discos?
We
don't go to them, so how would we know?
We don't. I don't even go to adult discos, so I haven't a clue whether that still happens or it doesn't. A lot of people, and we're going to come to this in a few minutes, highly critical of Sinn Féin in relation to the referendum. I want to say that a lot of people who are Gripped readers and people who listen to this podcast are coming from a perspective where you suspect they will be open to voting for Sinn Féin. Let's put it that way. They're not a fan of the current government. And you can see their fall in the polls being reflected in some of the comments about them that we're getting them. The stuff about holding the referendum again, for example, seems to have gone down really badly with and I apologize if the person who made this comment is not a working class voter, but they've gone down badly with working class voters. So Sarah Murphy says Mary Lou McDonald is a woman who will not accept the people's vote, with like five angry emojis behind it. And like, I think that kind of stuff really, it's a simple thing for people to understand and it sticks with them. If I don't vote the right way, you're going to make me vote again. And I think that's toxic for their voter base, to be honest.
I think that people, whoever the people are who are advising Sinn Féin for a number, and like you said, we'll talk about this in a few minutes, but like a number of their political strategies or political decisions or their political or their messaging for the last couple of months is dire.
Mm-hmm.
Whoever is advising them isn't doing a very good job, is the nicest way I can put that.
Mm.
I mean, I'm stunned. Talk about snatching defeat from the jaws of victory. They were on a polling high. They were, they looked like they were the face of change. And then somewhere between immigration and this referendum, it's gone.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think they've disappeared. I mean, they're no longer, and I noticed this I wrote a piece about 2 years ago talking about Sinn Féin, and their great strength was, I think, that they were aligned with the public on the two big issues at the time, in that the dogs would bark and the caravan would move past a whole range of issues and Sinn Féin would just be saying housing and health, housing and health, housing and health. And those were the two big issues for the public, housing and health. And I don't think they've adapted to the fact that while those are big issues still, they don't really have a vision outside of that. And it worked for them for a little while. And all of a sudden now, when we moved on to talking about immigration, or when things like these referendums are hot topics with voters who might be interested in supporting them, they have very little to say and they flounder a little bit. And I also think the fact that they've been banging on the drum about housing and health for so long, it just sounds old and stale. Mm-hmm. I think they have potentially serious problems. And I think coming off this referendum, if there is a no vote, that is going to embolden a lot of sort of government skeptical voters who will remember that Sinn Féin weren't on their side and will be going looking for alternative options in European local elections.
For sure. But I think what's interesting about this is, I never would have predicted it, and I've been so, and I think obviously quite rightly, critical of Labour on this podcast many times, but it's almost like what happened to Labour in government is happening to Sinn Féin out of government, in that a party that has, presented itself as being the party for change is actually anything but.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how they think that it's a good idea to support the referendum and agree with the government on pretty much everything How they think that's going to put position them as the party to vote for change is beyond me.
And even on another matter, I mean, this week, and it's not in our list of things to talk about, but I think it's a good example. The Shun Ní Ráithlí, Catherine Martin bun fight continued this week with the former RTÉ chairwoman, Ms. Ní Ráithlí, issuing a 5-page statement, which, you know, other journalists have been, you know, a bit more circumspect in describing it, but it was an excoriation of Catherine Martin. It basically said, look, she wouldn't even talk to me. I had like 2 meetings with her in the entire time that I was chairwoman of RTÉ. It wasn't 2, but it was very few meetings. She only talked to her officials. She was at arm's length. She didn't appoint people to the board with expertise. And Sinn Féin had virtually nothing to say about that and didn't even put down a symbolic motion of no confidence. We all know they wouldn't have won the motion of no confidence. But there's a moment where you can go for the government's throat and go for a minister's throat and make it a bigger sort of political event. And they just sort of shrugged their shoulders at it. And I think a couple of years ago, the killer instinct would have taken over there. I feel like I feel like they're uncertain about what to do. So they're doing nothing. They're kind of paralyzed and frozen. I mean, Sinn Féin is a political party that's unlike others in one way, in that they are obsessed with opinion polls. I think their confidence has been badly shaken by their recent fall in the opinion polls to the extent that they actually don't know what to do.
Well, that's an interesting theory. So that's what you think is happening.
Yeah, I do. I think they haven't. I think they haven't a clue how to react to their recent fall in the opinion polls, they're kind of frozen in decision. Would it harm us more to put down a motion of no confidence in the minister, or would it harm us more to do something else? And in the end, they decide to do nothing. And then they're kind of hoping that the immigration issue will go away by itself, which it won't. And they haven't adapted to that or come out with a coherent position on it. I think they're frozen by indecision, to be honest with you, which doesn't bode well, I would say, for them being in a government where you're going to get these kind of setbacks every day of the week.
Are they going to be in government at this point? I mean, I thought it was kind of an obvious thing that was going to happen a few months ago, and now I think it's not.
Hmm.
And I don't think that people have any vision of what a Sinn Féin government would look like, how it would work, because they're so silent.
Well, I think it's going to be one of those where they may well emerge as the largest party in the next Dáil by default. But I think a couple of months ago they would have been in the driving seat to form a government, in that it would have been obvious that them plus somebody else would have been the obvious choice. They would have had a clear mandate. I'm not sure their mandate is going to be anywhere near as clear, and I think it could be an absolute. It could be a no, I mean, do you remember the last election? It took what, 3, nearly 4 months to form a government. I mean, I think we're heading for a Belgium situation here, where like it could take 6 months to negotiate something amongst all these people.
But what, that it would be Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil and a cobble of other people negotiating for months and months and months about something again?
Or Sinn Féin and Fianna Fáil or whatever. Like just some gaggle of parties trying to patch something together, which includes 10 or 12 independents and the Social Democrats and, you know, whatever's left of the Labour Party.
Do you not find that super depressing? I mean, I think like for, you know, a variety of reasons, some time on the bench would be really good politically for Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil to get new leadership, recalibrate, figure out what your plan is, figure out what you stand for, etc., etc. And like all of them kind of like this kind of half-dead march back into the negotiations again in a few months to put something together is fairly depressing. Do you not agree?
Well, I do, but that may be what the voters decide. They may decide that they don't like any of them. And if they decide that they don't like any of them, that's what we're going to end up with. Because that's what happened the last time. The voters basically decided that they split their votes evenly between 3 parties and said, we don't like any of you, sort it out. And this is what we got. I mean, you know, and it's one where you can't blame the electorate, because you can't say to the electorate, just pick somebody. Because, I mean, voters, a voter in Tipperary can't talk to a voter in Kerry and kind of go, do you know what we'll do, lads? So it's just one of those where what always strikes me about the opinion polls, Sarah, is the party leader satisfaction polls. Like, and the most popular leader in the country at the moment is, I haven't got the figures in front of me, but my point is, whether it's Mary Lou or Micheál or whoever it is, they're on like 41% approval. Now, if you think back to Bertie Ahern when he was the Taoiseach, him and Mary Harney used to repeatedly get like 63, 64. People were happy generally with the job they're doing. there isn't a single politician in the country at the moment that a majority of people say is doing a good job.
But I never really understand that part of the poll, and maybe you can tell me. But is so if 42% of people are happy with Micheál Martin, why? Who is that? So I don't really get the leadership thing. So are you asking me if I'm being polled and you say to me, who are you planning on voting, giving your number one in the next general election to? And I say Fianna Fáil. Do they then subsequently ask me about the different leaders and I'm polled on Mary Lou?
Yes.
But yep. Like, but why would that be?
Well, because you're being asked a different question. You're being asked, do you think she's doing a good job as leader of Sinn Féin or a good job as leader of Fine Gael, even if you're not voting for her? I mean, a couple of months ago, if I'd been asked that question, I would have said, yes, she is. If I was asked it today, I would have said, no, she's not. Because I don't think she's being an effective leader of the opposition, even if I wouldn't vote for her anyway. I think you can, you know, for example, I think Keir Starmer in the UK, even though I wouldn't vote for him, is doing a very effective job as leader of the opposition. So I think that's the question.
What does that information tell you? It tells you that 42% of people think that I'm just not like I've never really understood what you're trying to get out of it. That 42% of people think that the other guy that they're not planning on, like 42% of people, let's say, think that the leader of a party, let's pretend it's Ivana Bacic, that 27% of people polled think Ivana Bacic is doing a good job. Like, obviously, I've made up those figures because I doubt 1% think Ivana Bacic is doing a good job. But like, that I'm never, ever, ever going to vote for Labour. But I think she's doing a good job. Just doesn't make sense to me. And I don't really understand what you're even getting out of that data.
That's because you're a political nerd. But I think it's best understood as a measure of respect. It's like, do you agree with this person? You might disagree with this person. Do you respect them, the job they're doing? Like, I didn't vote for Bertie Ahern's party in the 2007 general election, for example. I voted for Lucinda Creighton in Dublin South East, where I was living at the time. But I would have always said he's doing a good job, you know, or I respect him. I think he's been a good leader of our country. I just don't necessarily agree with his policies. And he always polled vastly higher. And even Enda Kenny always polled vastly higher than these guys. Mm. Anyway, regardless of what it is, maybe I'm wrong about what it means, but that figure has fallen dramatically over the last 20 years. And I think that's not unrelated to the sort of fragmentation. There isn't a leader in the country who people think is doing a good job or worthy of respect or whatever you think that number means.
Yeah, anyway. And maybe, yeah. I think that I have noted with amusement how people in Fianna Fáil, for example, and Fine Gael sometimes will polish a turd, as they say, when it comes to polling about, you know, trying to make it positive. So they'll say, you know, their party will be down 6 points in the poll, let's pretend, but their leader will be the second most popular leader in the country, according to the poll. So they'll, you know, lead with that and then add their party number and the other two parties that are in government with them together and say government still has a majority because the combined number now of all three is 51. And it's like, okay, guys, you know, whatever helps you sleep at night. But no.
Well, it's nowhere near 51 at the moment. I think their combined polling is in the high 30s or low 40s, which is not re-election territory. Anyway, we've talked enough party politics for 1 week. Let's talk some policy. You were taken by the proposed changes to sex education this week.
Yeah, well, I mean, I suppose taken is a loose term, but so there's a proposal to introduce, you know, a new curriculum around sex education because, you know, we continue to be absolutely obsessed with teaching children about sex in school. So I'm, you know, like pretty perplexed by one part in particular, which is unit two of this proposal, sexual orientation and gender identity, which introduces the gingerbread person. And to understand more fully what we mean by different aspects of our sexuality, let's look at the gingerbread person.
Okay.
Sexuality is our understanding of what it means to be male or female and how we choose to show that in all aspects of our lives. Our sexuality is made up of four main elements: anatomical sex, gender identity, attraction, and gender expression. Gender identity is about how you see yourself, how you see and feel about yourself as male, female, both, or neither, irrespective of the sex you are assigned at birth. Give me a break.
What age are they teaching that at?
Primary school.
So they're going to teach primary school kids that, you know, you are what you say you are, basically.
Yeah. So it's from 6 to 12 years. I mean, I'm not surprised. Like, you know, we've had the conversation on the podcast before about some of the books that were subsequently removed, but that talked about, I think Grindr was mentioned in the book, if you recall.
It's very funny. Did you see the video where I asked Fatima to read that book?
No.
So if you're watching this on the Grip YouTube channel, it just go up to the search bar and or go into our videos and go and see if you can find the one of Fatima reading the book. So I had this idea that I get Fatima to read. I think it was This Book Is Gay, which is a book for kids. And like, I thought to myself, you know, she's a young woman. She read this book, you know, on camera, people would get a sense of her reactions to it or get a sense, just understand what's in it. But it turned into the funniest video in the world because Fatima just couldn't contain her disgust at some of the stuff that was in it. So her facial expressions are gold. They're gold. She was supposed to keep her face neutral and she just couldn't do it. And if you're listening, Fatima, I'm not criticizing you. I think it was very funny. But the content is genuinely shocking. Mm-hmm. Like, it's shocking. We're talking here detailed instructions on rimming and blowjobs and hand jobs and all the rest of it. And, you know, and then you have, for younger people, you have this idea that, you know, you can be whatever you want. It's just a bizarre obsession. I mean, I don't understand. I mean, did you see today there's another report which shows that Ireland now has the highest rate of gonorrhea in Europe and some of the highest rates of chlamydia and what's the other syphilis in the Western world. And you're like, it's like we've been putting sex education younger and younger and younger for years and years and years, and the result is we're now the island of the clap. So it's not even working on its own terms.
But that's not what it's about, and you know it. I mean, this isn't about safe sex. This is about normalizing, you know, an agenda. It's an agenda to have conversations that normalize, in this case, transgenderism.
Yeah, transgenderism and gender fluidity and all these sorts of things. Because, I mean, it's not only transgenderism. It is now, I think it's in the U.S., which, and like all bad ideas come from the U.S. these days. Mm-hmm. I think there are figures showing that like literally 1 in 5 young people identify as LGBT in some way. And a huge proportion of that is being driven by young girls in particular, not necessarily identifying as transgender, but either identifying as bisexual or gender fluid or one of those other kind of identities that isn't really real, where you can say that you're something different to the norm. I'm going to get into really controversial territory, but I think figures have shown over the years that the vast majority of people who identify as, particularly young girls who identify as bisexual in their teens, will go on to marry a man and have a normal life. In that, for a lot of teenagers in particular, it's almost a kind of state sanctioned, encouraged form of rebellion that we're kind of encouraging people, like, which is bizarre because rebellion, it should be against this stuff, not like carrying down that path. You know, but that's what it is. It's not. I mean, obviously there are a number of kids who are being affected by the perception that they're transgender, but there's a much greater number kind of using dodgy pronouns or declaring that they're gender queer or, you know, two spirit or whatever the latest buzzword is. And this is nonsense. It's being actively encouraged by the state. So two spirit is, It's actually something that's been culturally appropriated from Native Americans. So Two-Spirit basically is the American Indian, with the American in some American Indian in the like 1820s or something, was apparently a bit, you know, unclear as to what he was, and became known as the person of two spirits. So if you're a man one day and a woman the other day, some American institutions refer to you as Two-Spirit. I know. Look, it's just all nonsense.
What? So you have two spirits inside of you?
Well, yes, in that you have a female essence and a male essence, and they express themselves in different ways. But why are you making me explain this like I'm in the National Women's Council? I think it's nonsense, but I think that's what they...
Because I think there are people, because, so firstly, I ask questions. I was actually asking somebody a question about something similar to this the other day, and I'm genuinely not trying to be funny, and that I don't understand what you're saying. And I think there are a lot of people who listen to this podcast who be the same. I don't understand what that means, that you have two spirits inside of you, and one is sort of male and one is sort of female.
Yeah, they both come out at different times.
I'm old enough to remember that when you had voices in your head, you went to some sort of professional. Like, what do you mean you have two spirits inside? I mean, everybody has elements to their personality. You know what I mean? Like, as in, I'm sorry, no, it sounds like I'm trying to be funny and I'm not. I just think it's mental. I'm sorry.
So I looked it up here while you were asking the question. So the LGBT section of the internal of the Indian Health Service of the U.S. government, which looks after Native Americans, says traditionally Native American two-spirit people were male, female, and sometimes intersex individuals who combined the activities of both men and women with traits unique to their status as two-spirit people. In most tribes, they were considered neither men nor women. They occupied a distinct alternative gender status. Now, as far as I know, almost all of this is entirely invented from whole cloth. I think they found like two or three examples. And so now it's all of a sudden a Native American tradition that we must all respect and indeed emulate.
I see what's happened. They've taken something from Native American culture and tried to make it into something that suits the agenda.
Yeah. So we talked a few weeks ago about the poor old Roman Emperor Elagabalus, didn't we?
Yes.
Yeah, and he was apparently introduced in his time as being somewhat effeminate, before he was murdered at the age of 19 for being insufficiently masculine. So now there are any number of scholars who will tell you that he was the first transgender Roman emperor. It's the rewriting of history to justify modern mores.
It's also the attempts by people who are, you know, kind of nerdy to try and make their area of whatever academia cool.
Yeah. This is the other thing. I mean, so much of this stuff, particularly in the young, I think, and you and I are not too far removed from having been young ourselves. But a lot of it is just the desire to be different and the desire to be special and the desire to have special attention. And mm-hmm. If all of a sudden you're not a woman and you're not a bloke, you're actually demigender, well, that makes you different. It's, you're a bloke, but you wear a pink scarf, so you're a demigender. Or, you know, whatever, pick any one of the 73 different genders that some of these people recognize, and you know that's what you are. It's just a way of it's state sanctioned acting out.
Yeah, it's like
in our day you just became a goth
or a vegan.
Yeah, I preferred the goths.
Me too. But yeah, no, it's about trying to make yourself interesting when you're not, kind of thing.
Anyway, this is what's being taught to kids now, that the gingerbread person, you can decide what you are. What else does the gingerbread person teach us, Sarah?
The gingerbread person teaches, we're teaching the children. Hold on, let me just bring it up here. We're teaching the children that, you know, gender isn't real. And hold on, where is he here? Oh, attraction. Explores how you are drawn to other people romantically or sexually. Sexual expression is how you choose to show your gender in everyday life through your behavior, the way you dress, your mannerisms, etc. And then anatomical sex. A person's sex is generally assigned at birth based on the baby's anatomy or physical sex organs. You have already explored the physical changes of adolescent in strand one. You will look at this more detail in unit three.
Can I go back to something there? Because there was this thing you said there a second ago. You said a person's gender expression is how they express themselves with... Give me that again. Because there was something in there. It was like expressions or something like that.
Expression is how you choose to show your gender in everyday life through your behavior, the way you dress, your mannerisms, etc.
That's fascinating. What's a female mannerism?
Oh, gee. So...
Is it playing with your hair or something like that? Is it Is it batting your eye? What's a male mannerism? Is it scratching your arse?
Yeah, and other bits.
I mean, like, is this... Because
this is the issue that I would have as well, which is that consistently you see people that the entire concept of womanhood is something you can kind of throw on with a wig and a dress.
Yeah, yeah, that's it.
That it's not anything, that it's that you can become a woman and it's just a matter of the mannerisms and it's just a matter of this and it's just a matter of that. And it completely devalues and debases the fact that, you know, obviously I can do things with my body that you can't.
I'm old enough. And and by the way, if I was 10, I'd still be old enough to remember that when the psychos, because these people are psychos, in my view, had like the world's biggest freak out at the Late Late Toy Show about 10 years ago because of what they called the pink toy problem. Do you remember that? Where like the little girls we brought onto the toy show and they'd be given Barbie dolls and the little boys we brought on, they'd be given like blue action men. Wasn't exactly like that, but you know, that would be like gender roles being assigned to kids, and girls not being told they could play with action men. And now these same people are lining up to tell us that your gender expression is about your gestures and mannerisms. So if you are an effeminate boy, well, you're obviously choosing to be a woman. I nearly said a bad word, but what the feck?
Yeah, don't forget that those girls were lining up to get Barbies, but now Barbie deserves an Oscar and you're mean if you don't give it to her.
I was one of those unfortunate kids, you know, you didn't know me at the time, which is probably why we're friends. but I was one of those unfortunate kids whose voice didn't break until like quite late in puberty. So I was like a little fat kid of 14 who talked like a castrato. And like probably in some ways a little bit effeminate. Are my peers, if I go back in time with these books, to think that I'm choosing to express myself as a woman? There are lots of people like that. There are girls who are tomboys. There are boys who like Irish dancing or what have you. I mean, the stuff that we're teaching here is basically that if you're in any way different to the gender stereotype or that the state is now telling us that you have with your mannerisms and your clothing, well, you might be something else. It's toxic shit.
Mm-hmm. And really, really, really damaging and confusing. For, I mean, like on the toy thing, like I have two sons and a daughter and I've never... especially, you know, your first child, I could care less what toys he played with. And he blatantly went for balls and trucks. And as you recall, you have this weird thing about batteries for a while. But he was very...
He's the only child in history whose affection I have bought with a very large battery.
So just... to explain that to people, he just went through when he was about two, this phase of collecting all the batteries is very annoying. You take them out of the back of remote controls, whatever. And he just liked the weight of them or whatever. And he'd collect them in these drawers and loved batteries. And then John spotted this. And the next time he came, he brought him like, what is that size of battery? Like one giant battery. And he was so happy.
Yeah, the big square one with the little coils on the top.
Yeah, it was like that video. Have you ever seen that video of the guy whose dog has this favorite chew toy and then he dresses up as a giant version of it?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, it was kind of like that. But anyway, the kids, like they all were very, the girl is into dolls. I mean, like I really am open to the idea that I might have inadvertently pushed one way or the other, but I really don't think so. I mean, when I see my daughter now, she's two in a couple of weeks. You know, she's mad into dolls and she would have been surrounded predominantly by boys' stuff because she's got two older brothers.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I mean, I wouldn't have cared, but a lot of kids, dolls and those kind of things were marketed towards kids because that's what they liked. Doesn't mean anything if you don't like that, if you prefer toys or, you know, whatever, boyish toys when you're a girl. But like this business that is kind of highly offensive and gender is just socially constructed, I'm sorry, but I don't buy it.
Yep. Look, and this is the thing that annoys me. The people pushing this stuff wouldn't have bought it 10 years ago.
Mm.
It's like they've reversed their entire worldview because all of a sudden the whole transgender agenda, which is sort of behind this. I mean, the need, the psychological need of campaigners on that issue to make us all profess that we believe in our heart of hearts that India Willoughby is a man, sorry, he's a woman, has forced them to reorder their entire worldview of gender and everything else. To the extent that where 5-10 years ago it was gender stereotypes are the worst thing in the world, now gender stereotypes are vital to our understanding of how you're expressing yourself. It's an inherent reversal. And like this, so many of these people are, I'm sorry, they're just, you call people dum-dums on this podcast, and I always laugh, but I nearly did it again. They're effing thick as pig shit because they don't seem to have realized that they've completely reversed their own view of this stuff from 5 years ago in service of an agenda that they didn't even dream up themselves. It's just, oh, this is the latest phraseology you use now, so we'll use that because we're conformists and we'll teach all the kids about it. I mean,
but it's also just a new religion, and they'll sit around without any self-awareness and talk about how people were brainwashed by the Catholic Church and people did this and people did that, and they curtain twitched and they got people, you know, with people threw their daughters out in the street if they were pregnant, and the church did this and the church did that, without any awareness that this is the new religion. They don't think for themselves. They go along with whatever they're told, and they will blindly allow their children to be taught this crap in school because they're afraid to say anything. Well, I'm not, and I don't want my kids to be taught this confusing crap. I don't understand it, so I certainly don't expect a 7, 8, 9, 10-year-old to understand it. And I don't understand why this agenda is consumed with teaching things to children. Is it simply a matter of, let's get to them as early as possible so they'll never question it?
I was very encouraged by something this week. I realized Twitter is not the real world. But I sent a tweet the other day that I thought was going to be really edgy and kind of get me in trouble. But I thought, you know, F it, somebody has to say this stuff. And it was a picture that Fatima took in the Oireachtas at an event they were holding for International Women's Day, where you had the independent TD, the last Cairn Corridor from Galway, Catherine something, I can't remember her second name, I apologize to the lady, Ivana Bacik, Marie Baker, and somebody else on the stage for International Women's Day, and the Irish flag behind them and the European flag behind them, but above that were three massive banners of the Progress flag, which is the what used to be the LGBT rainbow flag with now a transgender triangle in it. And it just struck me, like, it was like a scene out of a dictatorial country. Do you know where you'd have like the massive banners of the party behind you? And I sent this tweet saying, you know, why are these up? Like, it's not Pride Month. You know, that doesn't happen until June. There's no obvious reason why this ideology should have its massive banners hung in the National Parliament building. And I'm told, by the way, that they're everywhere in the National Parliament building, including in the toilets. And I thought I was going to get flayed.
Why
do I think I was going to get flayed?
No, why are they everywhere? Well,
nobody seems to have an answer to the question, other than that somebody put them up, and I presume nobody has had balls to say those should come down in case they're thought of as a homophobe or a transphobe or a, you know, whatever you have in yourself, phobe. But it's like, and Ken, you know, I mentioned a guy on the podcast last week, Ken, my friend, and I said I couldn't name him. I nearly used his second name there, but he said something to me that stuck with me. He said, there are people who say that this stuff isn't the national religion, but how would it look any different if it was the national religion? Like, what would look different? If this was a sort of like religious dogma that you had adopted, what would look different to how it looks now? I thought it was a very profound question because these banners, this iconography is everywhere. Every state-funded body has diversity and inclusion and people committed to promoting this stuff. Every state department makes people wear rainbow pins during Pride Month. Like, it is like a national religion. And I don't know how, if it was adopted in the morning as the national faith, I don't know how things would look any different.
That's a really good point.
And
also that it's not only that, but it's also that, you know, everybody who works there would be afraid of their life to even ask why the flags are everywhere in case they were accused of, you know, well, it's a form of blasphemy, isn't it, to ask?
Well, it's the kind of question that Ronan Mullen would ask. And nobody wants to ask the kind of questions that Ronan Mullen would ask, which brings us neatly to our final topic for this evening's podcast, which is the, I was going to say forthcoming legalization, but that's not quite true. The Oireachtas Committee examining the potential for the legalization of euthanasia / assisted dying has recommended by a majority vote, not a unanimous vote, because there are some people on that committee who are deeply opposed to the recommendation, that the state should legalize assisted dying for basically people with 6 months to live or less. What do you make of that, Sarah?
I mean, so they can do this without public consultation, can they?
There does not need to be a referendum, though.
Yeah.
There's nothing in the Constitution. Put it this way. There is nothing in the Constitution that will prevent it.
I mean, sometimes in the comments we've been accused, and I don't want to do this because I think it's a point well made, that there's somebody who's commented a couple of times, and I'm sure they're listening because they've commented the same comment, that we can be a bit kind of, not defeatist, but sort of like, you know, what's the word, kind of cynical about everything.
That we don't get angry enough.
Yeah, and that we're a bit kind of like, oh, you know.
Well, I've nearly said fuck a couple of times in this conversation, and now I've actually said it. Okay. So I'm pretty angry, I have to say, about the sex education bit anyway, and it remains to be seen how angry we are with this. But I'm taking your professing that you're pretty angry.
But I have felt, and I'm sure there are other people who agree, that this has just been, there's an inevitability to this. That's what I feel. I feel like there's, you know, we've gone through a number of referenda on a number of issues. Some I was, you know, like gay marriage, I didn't care, fine. Some like abortion, I did. And it's always just felt like this was the third prong in that. And so there's an inevitability to it, I think, with the government that we have. I mean, look, even if you just take this referendum that's going on right now, and there's misinformation, there's a cozy consensus amongst nearly all of the parties. And I feel like there's an inevitability to this, because that's what will happen again. A small number of people will come out and actively, you know, speak up against it. The government won't care. The government won't listen. The government will spread misinformation. The government will talk about a few sad stories about the really, really hard cases, and this will happen. And it's weird, because on the one hand, I'm not for it, but on the other hand, I've kind of accepted that this is a fait accompli, and it has been for a while. And I don't think there's any stopping it, unfortunately.
Oh yeah, I mean, I think you're unfortunately and depressingly right about that. But the one thing that might stop it is that I think it will actually be a lot harder than people think to find doctors in Ireland who are willing to do this. There'll be a few, to be sure, but I think it'll be very hard to find doctors in Ireland who are willing to give people a lethal injection. In fairness, there have always been a significant number of doctors in Ireland who take a pro-choice view on abortion, but that's different. Because it's different because, these are not views I share, but the preponderance of pro-choice people are pro-choice because they do not believe that the unborn child is a human being in the same way that you and I are human beings. And they don't actually, or at least they tell themselves that they don't view it as killing. That isn't something you can do for somebody who's 60 years of age with cancer, and you're asked to inject them with, you know, a lethal dose of benzodiazepine or whatever it is they use. That's different. That is an active act of killing somebody who's indisputably a human being. And I think it was telling in the evidence the committee received that there were very few, if indeed there were any, Irish doctors or medical organizations that were like, yeah, this is absolutely something we'll do. But not, I'm sure that there are some doctors out there who'll do it. But I think there will be significant difficulty in accessing the service, even if it's technically legal. At least I hope so, because I think it's such a huge step to take. You can only do this once. That's the thing. You can only say once that it is legal for doctors to kill people. And once you've stepped across that line, I don't care what anyone tells you about, oh, you know, this is the slippery slope on steroids, because somebody in great pain with only 6 months to live, okay, fine. But why are they more special than somebody in great pain with 20 years to live? Like, you know, if your life, all of us are guaranteed to die. That is the one thing that is absolutely certain. And this business of foreseeable death, every single one of us is guaranteed to die. And if you say, well, I should have this because some doctors say I'll only live 6 months. If I'm in agonizing suffering, whether that be mental anguish, physical anguish, whatever it is, I mean, why am I being discriminated against? I mean, in Holland and Belgium now, there are cases where they're offering euthanasia to children. In Canada, they're offering it to homeless people. Like, it's...
Oh my God, that is perverse.
Isn't it?
Well, we just did it on the podcast a few weeks ago, that case. I brought it up of the girl who had availed of assisted dying because she had ME.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, her last tweets, it was dark.
Yeah, we had a whole conversation about the glorification of suicide, as I recall. I thought I'd get more blowback on that, but there wasn't much.
Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
So, I mean, I think that it's very hard to, as you say, once you legalize that people are allowed to die in that way, the slippery slope is inevitable. And it's a real worry, but... I mean, it's been kicked down the road a few times. You know, if there was a snap election, it'd probably disappear for another year or two. But I don't know. I've just felt like it's coming for a long time. So oh, I'm not.
I think so. And by the way, to listeners who heard my dog going off there for a second ago, she thought she heard the postman. And she should know that the postman does not come at this hour of the evening. But nonetheless, she thought she heard the postman. So if you heard that, I apologize. But you're... Yeah, I think it's really depressing. Now, the only note of optimism is this is just a committee recommendation. The Oireachtas will still have to. This isn't going to happen this side of an election, put it that way, because there's got to be an election in the next year, and there's no legislation drafted on this or anything of that nature. And it is possible that the election will change people's calculus on it. But it's another one where I don't know what Sinn Féin's policy is.
Yeah, I forgot about them.
Yeah, I have no idea what their policy is. For that matter, I have no idea what Fianna Fáil's policy is or what Fine Gael's policy is. And I think the one encouraging thing about this report, and it's certainly something we'll be doing at GRIT, because I think it's important for the public to know, it's really important to pin the political parties down on this at the next election. Are you going to go into an election pledging to legalize assisted dying?
Why? I'll just go on a journey afterwards anyway.
Don't depress me even more. I mean, we have to have some faith in the democratic system.
To do with the democratic system, that's to do with the cynicism of people.
Yeah, true. But anyway, look.
And they'll see where the wind is blowing, and then they'll have a journey, and then they'll change.
Well, that's all we can do as a media outlet anyway, is try and get them on the record and see what their position is, because I think they'll be reluctant to go into an election pledging to do that. As you say, they may well go on a journey afterwards. They've all been on journeys. They're all continuing their little journeys. The country is continuing its journey. What the destination is, nobody knows, but we love the journey.
The DART is having less journeys.
Yes. Well, none of us are going to be going on a journey on Metro North anytime soon. That's the only thing.
Well, you know, how else would you get to the children's hospital?
All right. Look, I think we will leave it there for this week. We've depressed the people enough. If you listen to this to be depressed every week, I'm very sorry. But I hope, as ever, that we've cheered you up by letting you know that you're not alone in the country and that there are some people out there who share your misgivings about the direction of travel. And if you're somebody who doesn't share our misgivings about the direction of travel and thinks we're mad and listens to us anyway, well, thank you for that too. But Sarah, unless you have any last words.
No, if you're listening to this and you disagree with everything we say, well, good for you, because not enough people listen to people who don't agree with them. So we'll take it.
That's true. All right. Well, then, until next week, that was another edition of The Week That Really Was. I've been John McGurk. She's been Sarah Ryan. We'll see you at the same time next week. But from us, goodbye and have a great weekend.